I'm opening the Subcommittee on Natural Resources for the Joint Ways and Means Committee for June 22nd, 2017. We're going to start off with a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3350 relating to outdoor recreation. And we have three people who are signed up to testify. Did you want to give us a little preview on that? Or?
Yeah, I should.
Thank you.
You need to open it.
I'm going to open that. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, member of Subcommittee, House Bill 3350 establishes the Office of Outdoor Recreation within the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. The bill charges the Office of Outdoor Recreation with a variety of responsibilities, including coordinating outdoor recreation policy, assisting in developing or updating outdoor recreation management strategy of the department, coordinating with the Oregon Tourism Commission and the Travel Information Council. They serve as a clearinghouse for an information center for outdoor recreation stakeholders. The office is to develop data independently or through contracts with appropriate public or private agencies on the social, economic, and resource impacts of outdoor recreation in the state. And the office is also to promote the health and social benefit of outdoor recreation in coordination with other related state programs and initiatives. The bill directs State Parks and Recreation Director to appoint an associate director to serve as the executive head of the Office of Outdoor Recreation. Okay. The cost estimated to establish the position are in the 2017-19 biennium are $218,894. This accounts only for the establishment of the position, doesn't address the additional workload of the agency and additional staff that may be required for the office.
Well, thank you. I have three people who are signed up right now to speak. Jim Gardner, Adam Baylor, and Tom Wolf.
No, I haven't retired yet.
So. Whoa.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for the Outdoor Industry Association. OIA is a national association with a strong presence in Oregon. Our Northwest members include Columbia Sportswear, REI, and a host of other companies, large and small, that participate in the recreation economy in Oregon. We would commend this bill to your attention and hope that you would act favorably upon it. It is a bit of a companion bill to a bill already passed, House Bill 2143, which designated the first Saturday in June as Oregon Outdoor Recreation Day. And that bill has already been enrolled. And that bill goes through some of the statistics that are really pretty mind-boggling in terms of the importance of this industry to Oregon. It accounts annually in Oregon for $12.8 billion in consumer spending, 141,000 direct Oregon jobs that pay $4 billion in wages and salaries, and provide $955 million in state and local tax revenues. So it's a large industry, a growing industry. One of the objectives of this bill is to really supercharge that growth, coordinate activities, including economic development activities, that will hopefully bring even more of these great jobs to Oregon. With that, I'll pause.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Adam Baylor. I'm the Stewardship and Advocacy Manager for the Mazamas. I've been at that position about 4 or 5 years. And I also just want to really thank all the members here that have worked throughout this whole session on outdoor recreation policy, whether it's funding state parks or the Oregon Coast Trail, and now this opportunity here before us. But I want to just give you a quick bit of info of why the Mazamas support this. As it went through the House Economic and Development Committee, we looked at the policy. We believe that really having a point of head of outdoor recreation industry in the state, somebody that can go across jurisdictional lines, working with the Forest Service closely on their sustainable recreation plan, fostering business growth in the sector, was something that we have seen and needed, whether we're growing volunteer-based programs to get more kids outside on Mount Hood, whatever we can do to coordinate groups like ours. And we've seen that. We've been around for 100-something years now, and we continue to see these sort of similar problems. The bill also does help to bring together a group of advisors. It does create that linkage for citizens to have an input on what's going on. And if you look at our federal lands. There's not a lot of great input in terms of recreation policy. Some of the actual fee collection and some of the committees that are formed around those fee collections haven't been around for a while. So how can you create linkages for citizens to talk about recreation and bring those leaders to the table to develop good policy yearly? And the other part, I think, which is really fundamental and why we're here in the subcommittee today, is to talk about how to develop a long-term sustainable fund for outdoor recreation and conservation of our public lands. And I think that we have seen a great increase to the popularity of outdoor recreation just here in Oregon. You know, the Deschutes National Forest is considering a permit system for some of its wilderness areas because it's just so popular. People are going there a lot. And we realize that, and as Mazama is climbing and hiking throughout the entire state, we see this increase. So how are we going to be able to manage that moving forward? And having a state-level leadership position is a key way to do that. And I'll just end by saying that this year, North Carolina created a similar position, and we're kind of moving in that direction, I hope, and want to thank you all for your effort on this bill.
Thank you.
Co-chair Frederick, co-chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf. We're here representing the 3,200 members of Trout Unlimited. And Trout Unlimited supports 3350. Obviously, from what I've read, the outdoor industry, recreational industry, brings into Oregon $12.8 billion a year in economic boosts, whether it be to rural communities or to manufacturers producing the gear. $3 billion of that comes from fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing, so that's a substantial. So, of course, our members are concerned about that. And many of our members, as I mentioned in my testimony, use different – they boat, they hike, they do all sorts of things, many of them so they can get to fishing and hunting spots, but they do that. And it's important that one thing I've always felt is the outdoor industry, the outdoor users are very unrepresentative in the state, and there's not really an agency to deal with them. This would create a position to deal with the vast amounts of problems that might come up and needs of our hikers, our bikers, our paddlers, the people that use this wonderful state of ours and need an agency to represent them. And I do have concern about the cost, but I would like to see this bill pass maybe without any funding at the moment, and we can look at it in the future. And I just would like to close the story. And one of my favorite places to backpack into is Francis Lake, and I'm not worried about anybody going up there and using it, because it's a very hard hike, and most of you can't do it. But anyway, it's up in the Lost Teen Valley. You start at 5,600 feet. You climb to 8,500 feet, over 8 miles. It's long and boring without any water along the trail. And you get to this place, and when you get there and you're thinking up the last 7 miles, why in the heck am I doing this? And when you get to the top of the ridge and you look down into this valley with this beautiful lake with a stream and smaller lakes below it, and you realize you're going to catch tons of brook trout, see tons of wildlife, and you look across and see the Wallowas, you realize, huh, that's why I'm doing it. Now can I get a helicopter to chop them out? So, and that never works. But there are so many people in this state that use our outdoors, and I think creating this position that HB 3350 does is a needed thing here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Helm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Jim and Adam, I think we've had discussions at the Economic Development and Trade Committee and others that talked a little bit about the provision in the bill that allows for gifts from industry to be placed in the same fund and the appetite of industry to do that, and I think that would benefit the committee to hear those.
Co-chairs, Representative Helm, thank you for that question. Yes, the industry is very interested in helping this program succeed with specific gifts that are designed around specific programs, a remediation of a particular trail, a program, for instance, similar to REI is funding the research on this in University of California right now, a program that looks at outdoor recreation, guided outdoor recreation, as a essentially a very low-cost cure for PTSD. And that has been that's turning out to be very, very effective. So program what I don't think the industry would be able to do would be to fund that base FTE position. But beyond that, there's tremendous interest in funding what I would call specific projects, special projects that would be built around that through that device in the bill.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, how many times have you testified in the state legislature now?
If you can include agencies, it's 1,035 times.
Amazing, absolutely amazing. Gentlemen, I personally, I'm someone who would like to see this position created. I think it's very important for a variety of reasons. With that said, I'm left wondering whether this is the best agency to put this position in, and I tell you I'd be less than candid if I didn't admit that I wonder whether Parks has been suggested because they're a non-general fund agency, and so is this a politically expedient move, or is this the best place to position this particular creation?
Representative Co-Chair Witt, let me take a crack at that, because we did, when we were initially constructing and working on this bill, we essentially had three candidate agencies. The other two were Travel Oregon and the Economic Development Agency. And frankly, the one whereas they are limited in what they can advocate because this is not in the governor's budget, so they're not allowed to, you know, seek it themselves. They were the agency that was most receptive, eager, willing to put their shoulder to the wheel to make this happen. And that's essentially the reason that Representative Johnson and the other supporters concluded. I think Representative Helm was in some of those meetings, but that was essentially the reason.
Well, I think that's a testament to the great folks that work at Parks. They're here to serve the public, and no matter what we lay at their doorstep, I think they endeavor to do the very best for Oregonians that they can. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Girard.
Oh, thank you. Jim, the question, excuse me, that I have is, I understand what you want, but I'm a little bit conflicted in that it seems to me that you're going to have the problem of having too many cooks, and you might spoil the soup. And what I'm saying is, do you really want to make a trail expansion political? Well, on one side and not on the other, or vice versa, or I mean, you're asking for a voice, but I'm not sure that you want to open it up to the point where it's all going to become just a bunch of politics.
Co-chairs, Senator Girard, you know what I've really been impressed with as we've worked through this bill, because I think it's a test case for the proposition: is this, would this be subject to politicization? I've been struck by this bill, virtually more than any other bill in the building this session, by how incredibly bipartisan the support for this has been. I mean, it has really spanned the political spectrum to a very unusual degree, and I think given the nature of the constituency that is really being served here, including some constituencies that have not traditionally been as active a participant as others in the outdoor activity realm, I think you're going to see this as a real laboratory for bipartisanship. That's my personal view.
Just a follow-up. But, I mean, I deal with capital construction, and I have to tell you that things get very political. You might have to choose between a trailhead in Coos Bay versus one up in Marion Forks or something like that, and you're going to have people arguing both sides. And so that's what I'm concerned about versus someone that, you know, like the Parks Department that doesn't really have a, you know, I mean, they're going to try to do what's best for the state and not represent the individual areas.
Co-chairs, Senator Girod, I think there's always a risk of that, but one of the things, as I testified earlier in response to Representative Helms' question, I think one of the great things about this is you're going to be able to draw in some private gifts and grants, support for those kinds of projects that, that really aren't going to materialize otherwise. So, and I've just been struck by the you know, the attitude of some of our team members at Mazamas, for instance. It's a very open group of advocates that I think you're going to be, I think you're going to get a really good product if you pass this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, all three of you. Appreciate it. Well, this is a public hearing and a work session, so wanted to move. Yes.
Chair, we're going to hear from the Parks Department. I'm kind of curious on where they're at, but more importantly, are we, do we have this in place? Who's handling it now? And
We can hear from the Parks Department if you'd like to have. Can you come and answer a couple of questions for us? That would be helpful.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Sumption, the director at Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And with me today, I have our associate director, Chris Havel, who's actually been part of this process. So we'll answer all of those questions, but I think I'll turn it over to him so he can give you more of those detailed answers. And then we'll take questions from there.
Please.
Co-chair Frederick, co-chair Witt. My name is Chris Havel, the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. The department is, of course, neutral on the bill, but happy to explain our mission, how it intersects with the bill, and what we would do to implement it if it's passed. I can say just generally in the last year or so that we've been working with an initiative, the Outdoor Recreation Initiative, that was convened by Travel Oregon, but really brought a lot of the players in Oregon to the table in an unusual way, talking to each other about big issues. How is recreation, outdoor recreation in particular, spread across the state? Who benefits? And that's which communities benefit, which industries benefit, which people benefit, and is there a way to improve the way we approach that so that the benefits aren't concentrated into one particular spot, that we reach every corner of Oregon with the tremendous gifts that Oregon gives to its residents in a way that is sustainable. Everybody is conscious of not wearing out our welcome in outdoor recreation in Oregon communities without using up resources, without wearing people out, and also not just serving travelers, but serving people in the communities where they live. Everybody deserves a wholesome, livable place, and there are many ways to get there. A lot of social institutions, economic institutions that provide that, but the thing that really comes down to the foundation of the quality of life in many communities in Oregon, whether they're rural or urban, is your access to healthy outdoor spaces. Provides not just sort of spiritual and mental solace, but keeps you fit, keeps you active and engaged in the life, and gets you caring for the landscape in a way that's really hard to replace in other ways. When people are connected to their land and care about it, they're more civically engaged, and that's good for the state. And that's generally the approach that we take in the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department in managing the state park system. But we're also responsible for outdoor recreation in general in the state. We do survey work. We have partnerships with other agencies that really extend the reach of the department beyond the state park system. And this is a natural progression of that role. So while our commission and our leadership under Director Sumption focuses a lot on our existing programs, the things that we're directly responsible for, we also have a rapidly growing effort to reach out into communities that we don't currently serve directly and to bring together outdoor recreation interests across the state in a way that's productive for the state that keeps us moving forward. So just with that as a general outline, I'd be happy to answer any specific questions you have about.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, specifically, do we have anyone that does this in the Parks Department?
So thank you for that, co-chairs or Representative Esquivel. The department has leadership in place who work beyond the bounds of the department now. And we also run major projects such as the statewide comprehensive outdoor recreation plan, which is a statewide survey of recreation inventory and recreation demand and the gap between them with solutions on how to bridge the gap. And that's not an agency document. That's a statewide document available to planners or recreation providers across the entire state. So we do a lot of work, especially on the planning side, to push ideas out to every provider in the state, every community in the state. The leadership in place in the department that works on these outreach efforts are sort of split between several divisions. We have grants division, we have planning and research division, and we have our leadership division. But there isn't a single point that really brings all of those things together until you get to the director. And under the director, there is general guidance. But the director has a lot of other responsibilities, too, that are broad and soak up a lot of time. So one of the things that the passage of this bill would do is provide a good tip to the spear to bring all of those efforts together inside the department.
Yes, follow-up?
Simple answer, no.
Well, there are several people who do it, but there isn't a single
kind of,
person.
But you have no one person.
No one person.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. No, there's no one person who just does this all of the time.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I just wanted to say, and Lisa and Chris are hesitant to toot their own horns here. This idea started out, and it wasn't, I'm a chief co-sponsor of the bill, and I'm sort of tagging along on other people's work and happy to do so. But this idea started out as a position within the governor's staff, and it started out as being an Office of Outdoor Recreation that would have that individual plus a support staff of, I think, four or five.
Yeah.
It had a price tag on it of $5 million. Okay. Then Parks got a hold of this idea, and I can't remember who drew you in, but they came back with looking at their own resources and how they could develop a position that fills the gap. There isn't anybody that does this. We need somebody that does this. And they figured out how to do it with existing resources and just a little bit more. So this went from a very kind of grandiose cabinet level position to something that is going to be just as effective but a lot cheaper for the state within the department. And they did a great job piecing that together, I think.
Thank you. Yes, Senator
Jerome. Well, I think you heard, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think you heard my concern. Money's finite. And my concern is that by opening this up more so to the public, which you would think that I would be for, but it concerns me in the fact that who yells the loudest might get the decision, and we've had that in this building this year. So who's going to make the end decision? How is it going to be structured? And what guarantees do I have that it isn't going to be who speaks the loudest? Because you're looking at somebody, I love the outdoors. I mean, I live in it. If you saw my house, you'd know how much I love the outdoors. So it's extremely important to me, but I don't want to tie your hands to making decisions that I think are going to be just and prudent for the whole state, not just maybe a certain region.
So, co-chairs, Senator Gerard, I think the way you avoid getting captured by issues and special projects and avoid sort of just paying attention to squeaky wheels is to have a really good common understanding, boringly, at the policy level. Where are we going and why, and how are we going to get there? That discussion comes first before you start focusing on things like specific projects. How do you know a project is going to really benefit a community or the state in general? You refer back to some really foundational guiding principles. And I think by bringing the right people to the table at the beginning and having a genuine conversation about that, we've heard mention of sort of the bipartisan nature of this, and I would go a step further to say it seems to cut through every barrier that you could imagine, whether it's, you know, public, private, urban, rural. There's a just a deep desire to come to the table and do good work. And I think if you start there and you come to a common understanding, you're able to defend yourself against really loud but in the end unimportant projects that might pop up later. And that's the approach that we take now with our work. And it's similar to the approach that organizations like Travel Oregon take. And we would certainly be working with a lot of partners on this at the beginning. I don't know if that's direct. It's impossible to completely clear your way through like every obstacle before it pops up. But I'm confident in the abilities of our staff to think their way through those things and not get sort of backed into a corner that they don't want to be in.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Well, I'm going to move. I want to find out what do we need to do here.
Fine, you've opened up both the work session public hearings. So
right.
We'll just move on to the work session.
We'll move on to the work session right now. Are there any objections to this particular bill?
You need to have, you have to have a motion.
You have a motion?
And you have to have a vote.
Why don't you tell us this? Because I'm moving along. Sorry, folks.
Thank you, Chair Frederick, members of the subcommittee.
Wanted to get this going, so that's why.
In front of you on OLS, you do have the LFO recommended dash A2 amendment. The A2 amendment does two things. First, it provides a general fund appropriation to
Mr. Cutler. If I could just interrupt.
Representative Johnson, who's the chief sponsor, is here.
Oh, he's here.
He just arrived. So.
I was doing my business on the floor. Didn't know y'all were here.
Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, co-chairs. For the record, Mark Johnson, House District 52. Apologize for not being here. So what's been said so far? Good bill should pass.
There you go.
I don't even need to get in the weeds on this. I really appreciate you hearing the bill and working with you on it. But the Office of Outdoor Recreation is something that I've been considering for the balance of the last of interim period, working closely with Travel Oregon. Been on a part of a subgroup called Outdoor Recreation Means Business. I mean, outdoor recreation is definitely a huge contributor to Oregon's economy. And other neighboring states and peer states, if you will, that also have burgeoning outdoor recreation industries have a person who represents that sector of their economy at a higher level than state government. And that's what this is all about, is trying to create an intentional presence to be there to advocate for the industry as certain decisions are made that could impact access, affordability, what are the roadblocks that keeping us from expanding our tourism industry, well, not tourism, but outdoor recreation industry, and partner with folks like Travel Oregon and partner with folks, even like the agencies here, let's talk ODF&W and so forth that you guys work with. What can we do to make sure that we're not putting in place impediments or roadblocks so that this continue to flourish and expand? And there's just some really cool things going on. And even, you know, the OSU Cascades campus in Bend now is offering majors on outdoor product design and marketing. So we're at a different level than we've been. So this, I think, will help us to continue to grow, to flourish, and to create good-paying jobs and attract folks here that can bring their time, talents, and energy to continue to expand our state. So in a nutshell, I don't take any more of your time, but happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the representative?
No. Thank you very much.
Good to see you. All right. You want to continue?
Certainly. Certainly.
That's where I'm supposed to go, right? Okay.
On OLS in front of you have the LFO recommended amendment. This is the dash A2 amendment. The two things it does is, first of all, it provides a general fund appropriation to the department, the State Parks and Recreation Department, of $218,894 for the cost of establishing the position. And secondly, it does remove the fund that is created in the bill, and that's been pretty typical policy by the Ways and Means co-chairs, because the fund doesn't have a dedicated source of revenue. But I should note that in conversations with the agency, they certainly have a large number of funds within the Treasury, and they can certainly accept gifts, grants, donations to the ends that have been discussed today.
Thank you. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the LFO adoption of the A2 amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Witz moves the adoption of the A2 amendment from LFO. Are there any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
So the final LFO recommendation is that 3350, as amended by the A2 amendment, be moved to the full Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3350 as amended to the full committee with a do pass recommendation.
Chair Witt, Co-Chair Witt moves the HB 3350 as amended to the full committee with a do pass recommendation. I think we need to call the roll on that.
Except for discussion.
I'm sorry. Except for discussion. Sorry.
Yeah, not a problem. As I have stated, there isn't anybody that likes the outdoors more than I do, and there is an axiom that says, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And Parks is working really well. Having said that, I think everybody's heart's in the right place, and I'm going to vote for it, but I might change my mind at a later date.
Thank you. Chair Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to my own motion. I would note for the record that there is no reference here to any preference for any particular kind of recreation. I therefore assume and I hope that there's a general feeling that we will be publicizing all kinds of outdoor recreation, and none will take preference over any other.
Chairman, I'm sure hang gliding will be part of this effort.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Let me know when you're going to do it.
Film at 11.
That's right. Newsflash, film at 11.
Thank you very much. Now, any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Helm?
Aye.
Representative Power?
Aye.
Representative Lewis?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Yes.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Senator Frederick?
Yes. And
Carrier for the floors.
That'll be me.
Okay. I might change my mind.
Right. And for the House? Okay. Representative Helm? Okay. And for the Senate, I guess that will be me too.
You as well. Yes.
Okay.
Brush
Thank you.
Questions for the carriers.
So I'm closing the public hearing work session on House Bill 3350 and opening a public hearing on House Bill 2007. And we have Representative Stark and Taylor Smiley Wolf from the Speaker's office. There she is. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. Please have a seat and please begin.
For your record, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4, Southern Oregon. And thank you, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, for hearing House Bill 2007 today. As you have noticed by the fact that we have House floor at this exact moment while we're in here having a committee, this is the season where we have a lot of very important things that happened at the exact same time. And so the Speaker sends her regards that her responsibilities have taken her somewhere else today. This is a bill I've heard her testify on, I think, three different times, and it's very important to her, as it's very important to me. So to House Bill 2007, if you haven't noticed, we have a housing problem here in Oregon. And I'm gonna do a quick overview of the bill itself, because there's been a lot of controversy that I was not expecting that has popped up around this bill. And so because of that, rather than normally in a subcommittee, we would dive into the financial details, I'm going to give you a broad overview. There are a lot of experts in the room who can speak more specific to some of the details, but I'll give you an overview of what's going on. But when it comes to housing in Oregon, we've long since established several years ago that we have a problem. We have more people than we have housing for. And that doesn't seem to be changing. Our population is growing, and our housing is not keeping up pace. And so Oregon, many, many years ago, as you know, by being on this committee, developed a statewide land use planning. Now, quite frankly, I'm not a fan of the statewide planning as a whole. However, it's here to stay. And because it's here to stay, and we are working within that system, we have to make sure that that system works. And what I mean is that what we do as a state, we have to make sure that our local jurisdictions are synchronized with that. We want them to have local control, but it needs to be synchronized with our statewide planning in order for things to work as our planning system is designed to do. If we start having misalignments, we start having issues, and we've seen that for years and years now. This bill attempts to resolve some of those misalignments as well. So, overall, what does this bill do? There's a number of things. Well, the focus is on affordable housing. The focus is to make sure that more people have an opportunity to afford a house. And the reality is, as I mentioned the problem a minute ago, it's not just affordable housing that's an issue. Quite frankly, for me to move up here during the legislative session, I had to start to renting a place that was smaller than my family could realistically fit into, and I had to start renting back in October to make sure that I had a place for February. And I started looking a couple months before that. Yeah, this is the type of scenario we're in. It's not just affordable housing for lower-income individuals that we're struggling with throughout the state. We are just struggling with housing throughout the state, and so we need to find ways to deal with that. So to the bill itself, though, one of the things it does is it reduces permitting timelines if a project deals with affordable housing. And so right now, 120 days is the timeline to have a turnaround, and we want to bump that down to 100 days. People have asked, well, does that make it so non-affordable projects will be dismissed or put to the side? We have assurances that that is not the case, and that's not the intent of the bill. We just want to make sure that, look, if we're making it affordable housing, then we're going to get you to the front of the line, make sure we pass that quickly. The other issue is, why is it taking so long to have these applications and permit process? Why does it take so long to go through that? So we're actually asking DLCD to study the permit process and come back and actually give us some good answers as to why is this taking so long throughout the state and the different places. Another one is it's going to give assurance to developers who choose the clear and objective path that their permit won't be rejected. Now, this drives me crazy that this happens at different places in the state. You tell a developer who wants to build, they come in, they say, hey, can we build here? Yes. They go through some exercises. Yes, we think so. Okay, we want local jurisdictions to be very clear about the clear objectives moving forward so that there is a path to completion, that when we say this is your path, a developer can go through the path and make sure that there is an end result that results in developing in a place that's supposed to be developed. Moving on, another, it defines needed housing as all housing and includes definitions of affordable housing, and it requires local jurisdictions to stay true to the density and height that they have zoned for. Now, I was surprised, as I'm fairly new to this conversation, I've been working on housing now for about 2.5 years and slowly diving in. You guys have seen me in other committees testifying on similar things, but I'm continuously surprised at some of the glitches that we have in our system. Such as if a developer goes out and an area is zoned for 10 units, and zoned for 10 units, they want to build 10 units, and then the local jurisdiction might come back and say, well, you can only build 8. Well, why? Okay, we don't want that. If it's zoned for an amount and it's been proved in our statewide planning system for an amount, then it should be able to be developed to that amount. Because the more we reduce the developments, the fewer homes we have, the more we perpetuate the problem that we have. And again, we just want to make sure that we are able to catch up, if we can, with the population growth that we're having. Another issue that surprised me recently was to find out that only 80 of 240 of our cities and so forth have allow ADUs, accessory dwelling units. These are also known as the granny flats and so forth. And the majority of them, of our communities out there, don't actually speak to it, and therefore it's assumed that they cannot have ADUs. Now, we're not saying in this bill that we're going to make it so we're going to force everybody to have an ADU, or we're going to go beyond the zoning limits and over there. No, we want to stay within the zoning limits, but we want to make sure that what a place is zoned for, people can actually do. That's the goal of this. What our statewide planning is set up to do, that we can make sure that we are synchronized to do it. So, because, I mean, think of the alternative. If we need more homes, we have a couple options. We can build inside the AD or the UGB, or we can build outside it. And I haven't seen a lot of fans in this state that want to go out onto farmlands, that want us to sprawl out into the rural communities. And instead, we say, let's make it difficult to build. Let's keep our state beautiful. Let's make it difficult to build outside those limits. But also, let's make it so that there are good, productive, thought-out, strategic ways to build within the urban growth boundary. Okay, and this is trying to make sure that we are strategic in that at the state level and in synchronization at the local level. So one of the things that this bill also offers is the idea that religious organizations can build affordable housing on land they own in line with, again, with the residential zoning requirements. And quite frankly, full disclosure, there is a small chance that the church that I pastor could have an opportunity to take advantage of this. Okay, that's not their intent in any way at this point. But we own some property we bought prior to the recession, and we thought we were going to build. And the recession, things crashed. We couldn't move to this new property. So now we have this 10 acres that would actually be a perfect opportunity to build affordable housing, and it's tied up there. And so this is an option where we can say to local churches and organizations, look, you want to be involved in this? You have property. You have some special considerations for you. As long as it's within your zoning requirements, we're going to let you do this. And then on to the controversial point of the bill, National Historic Districts. All right. I was surprised to figure out what the controversy was, because when we first talked about this in Human Services and Housing, nobody showed up to oppose it. Or at least I don't remember anyone showing up to oppose it. It all came out afterward, and we did have a hearing on this, and we actually had an extra informational hearing on it later. But what's going on here is Goal 5 of our statewide planning. It's an important goal. It tells us that we need to make sure that we are preserving our wetlands. It has a whole list of things that we want to make sure that we appropriately preserve, including wildlife habitat and historic areas. That's very important. But when we get into a jam like we're in right now with our housing, we need to make sure that we take a look at things and we say, okay, we need to weigh a place for people to live and the value of preserving whatever the issue is. And so Goal 5 in our statewide planning says that you have to go through a local process to discover, well, which has greater value. And you have public hearings and you have input from people. Well, there's been a bit of a misalignment in how our state has moved forward with this Goal 5 and with the National Historic District designation. With the National Historic designation, it turns out that you actually can, without a whole lot of effort, it requires work and effort, but you can have a group, you know, like your homes association and so forth, apply on the national level to receive the designation. And when they do that, they automatically, you know, end up receiving this designation. And it makes it so that they can bypass Goal 5 for the most part and some of the protections of making sure there's a balance there. So this is not in any way saying you can't have your historic designation. This is saying if you want your historic designation, we need you to be synchronized with the statewide planning that we have, such as Goal 5, and to go through that process. And again, you know, Taylor and others can talk more detail on that. But the goal in no way is going to take away people's ability to have those National Historic Districts or designations, but just make sure you're going through the planning to make sure we are weighing all the important things that are out there. So overall, I'm excited that the speaker originally brought this bill forward. In fact, I was not aware of it until the public hearing that we first had. And immediately while she was presenting it, I started texting her saying, hey, can I jump on this bill with you? Because I believe that this is what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be building in the areas we've said to build. And we're supposed to be making sure that we're taking care of those in poverty and that they have a place to live. And we're supposed to be making sure that we protect outside of our UGB so that we don't randomly, without strategy, go out in those areas. I believe that that's what this bill does, and I believe that it's going to help us to recover in the affordable housing crisis that we have. I'm open for questions. Otherwise, if you don't have many, I will probably sneak back to the last few minutes of floor.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Frederick, and I know you have to go back to the floor, Representative Stark, but I want to make certain I don't want to have something incorrect on the record, and I know we have to go and someone else can probably correct it. Some things were said there about the hearing process and about, so I'd like to at some point we get on the record what actually happened with the history of the bill, about that there's informational hearing about who was allowed to testify, who was not allowed to testify, what was allowed to be put on OLIS, what was not allowed to be put on OLIS, because part of the controversy around this bill was how the hearings were handled, not any reflection whatsoever of Representative Kenny Guyer, because, of course, she's always does an exceptional job. But there, so I'd like to make certain that we have somewhere in the record what the hearing was, what the hearings occurred. So unless you happen, because you went back and forth on what you said regarding hearings, and there was no opposition, and there is obviously a tremendous amount of opposition. And if one were to look on OLS now, the opposition outweighs the proponents by any measure right now. But that was only possible when this public hearing was put on the record today, was put up for people to come and testify. Now people are able to express their opposition to it. So I just wanted, because we're friends, Representative Stark, and we go way back, I want to make certain that something, I don't want to have something incorrect on the record, and it's not necessarily your doing, but I just at some point want to get that on. If you want to comment on that before you go back to the floor, please.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, Senator Taylor. To that specifically, I will tell you my recollection of this.
Well, there's whatever the hearing process was, is what I want to know.
So we had a public hearing, and however, the public hearing, the bill changed significantly, and I think this is what threw people, with the amendment that was brought forward toward the end. Okay, so now I saw information on it, but the original bill was significantly different than what it was amended to be. We see that quite frequently in this building. And so those of us on the committee were not surprised by that. However, the changes in that amendment really turned out that it caught the community off guard. So there was a public hearing with very few people who came, but it's most likely because they didn't realize the amendment that was coming.
And now,
well, there was a public hearing. Okay, then we ended up having amendments in a work session. Then we received a lot, huge outcry of, wait a minute, the amendment is what people were not aware of, okay? And I fully understand how that could happen. So then I appreciated that that Chair Kenny Guyer went ahead and did a informational hearing, that she basically opened it up as a public hearing, but the bill had already moved on and had a couple hours of people coming and testifying at that point. And then now we're at this point. So I know that there was original, then there was the amendment, and then there was an informational public hearing, and then we're here with the public hearing.
Let me speak to something very quickly. One is that we have now 37 minutes left in this particular hearing. We have three pages of people here to speak. There's no way we're going to get to everyone. And I've got to apologize to that right now. We're not going to have 2 hours. We have 37 minutes. And that's a time issue. And we have 122 things that have been put in testimony on this, on OLS right now, in a short period of time. Part of it is because of the timing on the way that we, when scheduling the meeting, scheduling this hearing, you couldn't get anything on OLS until it was scheduled. So that's part of the issue. And you're right to speak to some of the issues in terms of timing and our process, which was screwed up as far as I was concerned. We should have had some more other things done. Having said that, I really want to thank you for being here, Representative Stark, and going through that and the process, telling us more about the bill itself. I think that we need to, if you don't mind moving, telling us a few things, and I don't know if you want to stick around or you need to get upstairs.
I have a feeling they're adjourning in 4 minutes.
So. Oh, okay.
So, for the record, I'm Taylor Smiley-Wolf from Speaker Kotek's office. I'm just here in case you have technical questions about the bill.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And there are two other representatives who want to testify, as I understand it, Representative McLean and Representative Marsh.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2007A today. For the record, I'm Pam Marsh, representative from House District 5, way at the other end of the state, southern Jackson County, including the communities of Ashland, Talon, Phoenix, Medford, and Jacksonville. All session long, we have talked about the state's housing shortage. And while much of that conversation has really centered on the more urban parts of the state, I am here to tell you that the crisis also extends to the far reaches of Oregon, including Jackson County. Data compiled for the American Community Survey indicates that Jackson County tenants are actually the most rent-burdened in the state, with more than 50% spending more than 30% and often much more of their income on rent. But with a vacancy rate of 2%, the families lucky enough to find a home are rarely in a position to complain about the rent. More than anything, this bleak situation reflects a shortage of available units. You all know the story. Oregon stopped building housing during the Great Recession, but we did not stop growing. Addressing the housing deficit, now estimated at 111,000 units, will require significant private and public financing. And unless we wish to turn farmland and open space into housing developments, and I do not, it will require communities across the state to increase density. House Bill 2007 provides reasonable state regulation to ensure that local governments step up to the task ahead. Housing developers, both in the public and private realm, need predictable permitting timelines and clear and objective design standards. Infill, in the form of backyard units and new development that maximizes existing zoning, will provide homes for very grateful community members in the context of existing neighborhoods. Now, my perspective on this legislation comes from years serving on planning commissions in two cities, as well as 4 years served as a city councilor. Out of that experience, I firmly believe that the preponderance of local elected officials understand and even embrace, at least theoretically, the concept of increased housing. But in our quest to preserve the qualities we love in our communities, it is easy to implement planning regulations and design standards that are nearly impenetrable. And it can be hard to stand up to residents who resist new development when they yell at you at city council member meetings. That's where the state plays a critical role. Our housing crisis will be effectively addressed when local communities, including advocates, neighbors, elected officials, tenants, developers, get serious about their housing responsibilities. It is the state's job to set and enforce standards that will motivate that action. And let's face it, a little bit of state leverage can provide some very helpful cover for local officials who are trying to do the right thing. HB 2007 is a critical piece of the state's complex housing strategy. I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McLean.
Thank you. Because of your time, I'm going to go off script just for a minute and maybe just give a little bit of a summary, because I believe that Representative Stark and Representative Marsh have done a really good job explaining what this bill can do with some minimums from the state. And I was able and lucky enough to be able to work with 23 cities. And I'm Susan McLean from House District 29.
Thank you.
And I have been very lucky to work with 23 cities and a tri-county area when I was a metro councilor up in my area. And working in local government, there were three items that were really necessary in trying to secure developments that would have affordable housing included in it. And one of the elements that the developers said they needed was they needed certainty. They needed to know that there was a process that they could depend on, and they needed a review process that wasn't so long that they were losing money as they were waiting in the queue to be able to do their development. And as Representative Stark pointed out, having the permitting timelines go from 120 to 100 days will help. Making sure that when you have a clear and objective standard that you are looking at, and that's the target you're supposed to hit, and you know that if you hit it, you can actually go forward and build your development. Development is something, again, that gives certainty to the developers that we're trying to get to actually build this affordable housing. Density and infill, there is still local control, and they have over a year to make sure that they have those clear standards and objectives that their personal community wants to use as the basis for the development review process. So local control is still there. They still have control on the density and infills that they are using in their communities. We have also heard a lot about historic districts. It's very important to understand that these historic districts will still be there, that you can still get your house and housing areas on historic districts, and that there's an opportunity, again, to have local control over what type of exceptions and protections that you want for a different important cultural aspect of your community. And in conclusion, I want you to know that there are over 20 organizations, and we have all kinds of folks on that are from different ends of the spectrum. People who care about land use, and as Representative Stark said, people who don't care about land use or don't like the system, but people who both appreciate and may have some ideas for changes do believe that it's important to use the land we have well and to make sure that our systems are dependable, that they are practicable, and that they really do allow for affordable housing to be built in our communities. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. I tried to make it short, and I know you've got a lot of people behind me. So thank you very much, co-chairs.
Thank you very much. And as a speech coach, you managed to make it just fine. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. I'm going to start off. Any questions for them? Yes, Representative, hold on. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McLean, Representative Stark said earlier that one of the intentions of the bill is to maintain current densities, and yet the bill also provides for ADUs in each community across the state. Does that not create an inherent tension, if not possibly a contradiction?
Well, first of all, ADUs, we need a variety of housing types, and ADUs fit in some places, but each community gets to have an opportunity to decide where do those ADUs fit into our particular land use zoning. And so they will have the opportunity to review that and make some choices that make sense to their community. I don't believe it's a contradiction, Representative Witt. I think that it, again, is trying to make sure that we have different types and different levels of housing for different income, strata across the whole spectrum.
Quickly, Ms.
Yes.
And the same question, possibly tension or contradiction between Goal 5. I know we've had now a couple of witnesses talk about local process, and yet the bill mandating ADUs locally.
Well, if you're connecting it with the natural resources and, the actual wetland, rules and those types of things, again, local jurisdictions get to make their rules on how they actually are going to fit that into their landscape.
Yes.
And they all have different landscapes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Was Representative Lewis? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For either one of you that might be able to answer this, I'm wondering, I understand the 100 days, but it also says in Section 1, Subsection 2, including resolution of all local appeals that have to be done within that 100 days. That would include Planning Commission hearings, any appeals filed by either one. Has to be resolved within 100 days?
My understanding is that the process is supposed to take 100 days just as it was to take 120 days, but we all know that if there is an appeal, that there are some additional processes to go through. So at this point, I'm going to have to tell you that I don't honestly have an answer to your question.
I'm sure Taylor can answer it, though.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Did you want a quick answer to that, Taylor? Could you come?
Sure.
Thank you.
Is the opponent?
Yes, we're
yep. Again, for your record, my name is Taylor Smiley-Wolf with Speaker Kotek. So I first want to go back to the ADU and duplex question. So the bill in the -6 amendments does say that every in single-family zones, for every detached single-family house, a city must allow an ADU to be developed, whether it's an external or internal ADU, and they can regulate siting and design. And then for duplexes, they must be allowed in single-family zones, but not on every lot that allows a detached home, so they could be corner lots or something. So I'm going to clarify that. And then to the question that is about the local appeal process. So Representative McLean is correct that in the same way that you have to resolve things within the 120 days, you must resolve in 100 days. But there are additional timelines that are granted in cases where certain types of appeals are filed, in which case a developer could get additional time to resolve that issue.
Thank you. Very, very quickly, please.
Yeah. So the language where it says including the resolution of all local appeals makes it sound like it has to be done within 100 days.
I believe you can apply for extensions, but I will verify and get back to you.
I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We only have a very short period of time, and I'm frankly, I don't know how to apologize enough about this because of the timing. I want to bring up, I'm going to bring up panels. The first panel is a group of people who are identified that they are against this particular bill, and that will be Rod Merrick, M.K. Hansen, and Dennis Osterlund. Are they all here in the room? I see two of the three. Oh, three. Okay, four. Three of them. That's fine. If you could come forward. The next panel that I'm going to call up will be Martha McLennan, Sheila Finklaw, and Allison McIntosh. So you should be ready if you are not in the room. Okay? Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. How many seconds do I have?
Right, you're going to have 2 minutes.
2 minutes? All right. I'll work on it. My name is Rod Merrick. I'm an architect, neighborhood leader, and pedestrian advocate. This bill has been transformed from an innocent-sounding bill to increase availability of affordable housing into an expensive and confusing response to everyone's concern about the housing shortage and affordability crisis. This is the first hearing since the bill came to light in April, and is very much appreciated. This is not the way to do land use planning in Oregon. After many amendments, HB 2007 lacks even a rudimentary analysis of the cost, benefits, legality, and possible impacts. If enacted as a law in the fundamentals of our state laws, comprehensive plans, local decision making are undermined. In contrast to its stated intent to create affordable housing, this bill in application will fail to provide any measure to increase affordable housing, strip away local controls of zoning and regulation, drive higher land values and taxes in single family zones, resulting in more, not less, costly housing, drive economic and social displacement as it has been in every city, add wasteful demolition debris to landfills, fuel renter displacement and decreased affordability, accelerate demolitions of affordably priced single-family housing, and double the lot density in single-family housing, because this bill provides for duplexes in every single-family house zone and makes it illegal to have single-family house zones, contrary to the way it's been presented. The undocumented cost to the state will be in the hundreds of thousands. The cost to local government will be in the tens of millions, including staff, public engagement, undermined credibility, and legal costs. The two interest groups behind HB 2007 have loaded it with provisions that compromise public good in exchange for increased profits. Thousand Friends of Oregon is waging a personal crusade to eliminate single-family zoning, historic districts, and local design regulations in Portland that they claim without facts are based in racism and driving housing costs.
Rod?
I've got one sentence just to finish it, and I'm done. Thank you very much. The slogan, housing for everyone, everywhere, is not about responsible planning, and it's certainly not about affordability. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Either way,
go ahead.
I worked really hard on this, and I'll try to make time, but please don't cut me off. This is so important.
Well, I understand, but I need two minutes.
I'm going to talk so fast.
Well, talk fast, but we're still going to time you.
All right.
Seconds already.
Thank you.
This is what affordability with a capital A looks like. Housing needs, constraints, and cost burden defined by the HUD standard of affordability, which is percentage of median family income. This is very important to understand when we're talking about real affordability rather than relative to whatever the market will bear. There is no housing crisis. There is only an affordable housing crisis. New construction is surpassing the need for market rate housing and woefully failing to meet the need for lower income supply. In fact, many luxury market rate units are sitting vacant, while an increasing number of people are being displaced, forced to live in their cars or worse. The housing supply has been inverted by a market rate housing boom. If the real name for affordable housing crisis is displacement, then the real name for displacement is injustice. Displacement caused by speculative real estate investment and gentrification are the cause of the lack of affordable housing supply, particularly where vacancy rates are low and rent increases and no-cause evictions are unregulated. When prices are raised to whatever the market will bear and demolition of affordable housing is unrestricted, lower-income families are priced out and that affordable supply no longer exists. Meanwhile, the housing market bubble is yielding exorbitant rates of return for investors. Wall Street recently created rental-backed mortgage securities and is now also in the landlord business. Market rate housing does not trickle down into affordable housing. In fact, it can take up to 30 years for those units to attain some semblance of affordability. Let this sink in for a minute. A speculative real estate gold rush happening simultaneous to a crisis of affordable housing, to imply that one has no relation to the other and that the current crisis is somehow caused by NIMBYism rather than the avarice of an overinflated market, is not only incorrect, it's disingenuous and dangerously misleading. Legislation which brings broad and dramatic change should be certain that it understands the root cause first. Otherwise, it is particularly vulnerable to erring on the side of irrevocable harm and regret rather than careful consideration and concern. House Bill 2007 is an attempt to further deregulate the conditions that caused the crisis of affordability to begin with. It will accelerate, exacerbate, and perpetuate the root cause and create even more pricing pressure by top-loading the market. It's what Naomi Klein refers to as disaster capitalism. House Bill 2007 claims to be an affordable housing supply bill, yet it weakens land use regulations statewide without mandating affordability.
And I'm going to have to cut you off, but there's something you didn't do at the beginning. Your name, please.
Oh, I was afraid I wouldn't have time, so I left that out. M.K. Hansen.
Thank you very much. I want also ask that you please send those graphs and those pictures as part of your testimony.
They're in there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for making the time to actually have this hearing, even though it's brief. I'm a 30-year resident of Portland and a native Oregonian. Like many others, I
And your name is?
Oh, Dennis Osterlund. Sorry. Thank you for reminding me. Like many others, I submitted my written testimony yesterday, and for some reason I decided to stay up late and read all of the written testimony that was put in. I think you said it's 112 now. 120, okay. So it was maybe slightly less than that last night, but still a lot. Took many hours. I'm sure that many of you are familiar with, on day 98 of the legislative session, doing such things. I'm not sure why I did it, but I did. Given your schedule and number of bills for consideration, I'm sure you're not going to have the opportunity to read those, to read all of those, but I'm sure you'll make a good effort. While I didn't do the math, it struck me that about 90% of the written testimony was opposing the bill. So I looked at it more depth and tried to determine, well, why is that? So first of all, those people that did support the bill, the majority of those comments were all associated with, unfortunately, the National Historic District issue, and that it was an undemocratic process. I just want to point out that the National Historic process has been in place for over 50 years and has over a million homes on its registry. So it's actually been working, you know, pretty well. So what about the 90% then that opposed? For two reasons, generally. Reason one was that they really generally believe in affordability. I believe in affordability. I have a small business. I have employees. I pay them a market rate salary. But in Portland, it's hard to find affordable housing. So affordable housing is important, but unfortunately, this bill does not provide affordable housing. This bill, unfortunately, provides the opposite. If we talk about the first base version of this bill before it started the amendments, it actually was a good bill. It wasn't perfect, but it was a good bill. But what's happened through the amendments is that things like the attack on historic districts, and even if it's not historic district, older areas, and I'm running out of time. The last thing I want to say on those, the way that you address in older neighborhoods affordable housing is ADUs. The bill mentions ADUs, but it doesn't really incent ADUs. Also, internal conversions is a key aspect for being able to get more density
I appreciate that, and I did see your presentation online. Thank you. I thank you very much. Thank you all three of you for being here. I've called up Martha McLennan, Sheila Fink Law, and Allison McIntosh.
These are full cities.
I was trying to do it. Yes, another panel. I have a panel of folks as well coming up, and that'll be John Liu, John McCullough, and James Gorder. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance in support of House Bill 2007A. I'll skip this since most of you know the Housing Alliance is a coalition of more than 80 organizations that represents a wide range of diverse voices. And we're here because we believe that all Oregonians need a safe, stable, and affordable place to call home. As you all know very well, today we simply don't have enough housing to meet the needs of residents in our state, and people with low and even moderate incomes are unable to find decent, stable homes they can afford. I think our members know all too well that no single strategy will address our housing crisis, and we need to try a range of strategies to solve these problems. To ensure that every Oregonian has a safe place to call home will require all of us in our communities to make commitments to address this issue. Adding to our state's supply of affordable housing with diverse and affordable options is a critical piece of the solution, and affordable housing is a key piece of our community's infrastructure. House Bill 2007A includes a range of strategies that will help increase our supply of affordable housing, particularly housing that's affordable to people with very low incomes. I just want to speak to a few pieces of the bill today very briefly. First, the bill would reduce permitting timelines for housing that's affordable to families earning 60% of the area median income. Just for an example, in Multnomah County, a household of four earning 60% of the area median income earns about $45,000 a year. That could be a single parent with kids who's working as a mechanic, a social worker, or a bus driver. Those are members of our community that we desperately need to find housing for. We also need housing for a range of incomes, and we know that we most desperately need housing for families earning the lowest incomes in our state, and we really appreciate the prioritization of units for people earning 60% of AMI and below. Second, the bill allows religious institutions to help address our affordable housing supply crisis. There is a church in North Portland that's trying to do this by building affordable housing on some excess land, and we're really excited about that piece of the bill. And then third, the bill encourages increased density by requiring local jurisdictions with reasonable restrictions to allow duplexes and ADUs. And these kinds of more affordable housing options will give Oregonians access to housing near jobs, schools, grocery stores, and transportation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure who's Lisa. Yes, please introduce yourself.
Yes, Co-Chair Frederick and Witt. My name for the record is Sheila Greenlaw Fink. I'm the director of the Community Housing Fund in Washington County. And I'll provide written comments, but just highlight a few things today. There's no question in Washington County that our county chair and mayors have all spent more time on this issue than any other over the past couple of years. It's a crisis, and they are looking to you to work with them to provide certainty and to find the path forward. Because we, as a housing fund, provide pre-development and land acquisition funding for groups that want to move projects forward, we hear from a lot of developers, but we also spend, I'd say, as much or more of our time with local jurisdictions. And they want to do the right thing, and they want to be able to act quickly and efficiently and fairly. And I think the provisions in this bill give them additional tools to do that, and they're looking for those. Just as an example, recently, City of Forest Grove doing an affordable housing strategy, the item that came up as highest priority, and it's still in draft stage, was accessory dwelling units. And they have a lot of questions about just thinking within the state framework and then with their local comp plans. And so I think this bill does a lot of positive things to help jurisdictions work with the state within the land use guidelines that we have, but to do it in a little bit more certainty than maybe they've been able to do. And just can't emphasize, as we see projects closing down and people being put on the street, how important it is that we do what we can at all levels to work together and provide certainty and keep moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Elise?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, you all know I'm not Martha McLennan. I'm here because Martha McLennan had to leave just moments ago to attend another housing speaking project. Elise Brown for Oregon Opportunity Network. Oregon On is a statewide affordable housing community service program network. And I did want to, in her absence, actually ditto the comments that you just heard from my experts to the left and put on the record officially that Oregon On is here in support of 2007A. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I called up John Liu, Terry Parker, and John McCulloch. If you could come up, and the next group will be Fred Leeson, Dean Giswold, and James Gortner. Gorter. Yes, please introduce yourself and continue. We're trying to keep going here.
Chairs, members, my name is John Liu. I'm a resident of Portland. I'm going to focus on three words here. The first is demolition, the second is historic, and the third is density. So what this bill, in effect, will do is it will accelerate the demolition of affordable, smaller, older houses, and they will be replaced with new houses costing over twice as much. And I say that with confidence because that is exactly what is happening in Portland right now. In the last 10 years, Portland has lost over 3,000 smaller, affordable houses. On average, in recent years, those demolitions cost about $350,000. In other words, the house cost $350,000. They have been replaced with houses costing, on average, $780,000, over twice as much. In the few cases where developers have built new construction duplexes, those are costing over $600,000. So the new construction is twice as expensive as what was destroyed. And so what is changing neighborhoods? What is displacing persons of low and moderate income? What is gentrifying neighborhoods? It is this sort of demolition development activity. Historic. This is an interesting topic because historic districts, residential ones, represent 1.5% of Portland area. They're tiny. And yet, they're a focus of this bill. The reason is because historic districts inherently contain a lot of older, smaller houses. Older by definition, really. And smaller because 100 years ago, most houses were smaller. So historic districts contain a lot of the kind of houses that developers target. They buy them, demolish them, replace them with things costing twice as much. The neighborhood changes, and it's not because the residents are trying to change it. It's because the developers are changing it. Finally, density. In historic districts, the rules allow houses to be reused by converting into duplexes and triplexes. Reused, not replaced. In historic districts, the rules allow houses to be expanded with accessory dwelling units. In other words, in historic districts, including National Register historic districts, we can have density without demolition. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, please.
My name is Terry Parker. I'm a fourth generation Portlander. What makes Portland, Portland, and a desirable place to live? It's a uniqueness of the urban environment that includes a multiplicity and diversity of well-established and preserved single-family home neighborhoods with big mature trees and green yards. That could all go away if developers have their way. The overreach of HB 2007 preempts local control and undermines, thereby gutting, single-family zoning. HB 207 is misled through the legislature under the disguise that by tearing down existing family homes with yards and replacing them with larger footprint structure or multiple units will create affordability because it increases the overall supply of housing. This has not worked in other cities such as San Francisco and Vancouver. Playing the Trump card, the push for this statewide preemptive smokescreen is in play because the home builders, along with 1,000 Friends of Oregon, now the de facto 1,000 enemies of single-family home neighborhoods, did not get what they wanted through Portland's comprehensive plan, the residential infill project, and the public process. The cover-up is that by tearing down the most affordable and single-family homes and then replacing them with a new structure will in reality increase the cost of housing across most income levels. Even when multifamily units are constructed, the new housing will come at a higher cost. First-time buyer and starter homes are already being demolished at an alarming rate. Replacement housing nearly always has a higher price tag. By giving developers carte blanche, as in HB 2007, the term RIP city will be quantified as never before brought to fruition. The greedy will take advantage of any opportunity where they can utilize what could be called bulldozers on steroids to rip apart neighborhoods and maximize profits. With single-family homes already in short supply, the American dream of an investment in home ownership will only be available to the top percentile of income earners. The impacts of lost green yards, mature trees, and open space in the urban environment will be forever lost. Finally, to avoid destruction of green in the urban environment and not add applications that further increase housing affordability over the long term, limit HB 2007 only to the positive aspects. Streamlining review, establishing clear and objective standards for affordable housing, and allowing religious allowing housing on church property or simply vote no. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just so that you know, we will not be voting on this today. So,
I understand.
Understand that that's an important factor. Yes, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm John McCulloch, and I am a developer. I'm a historian. I'm also a fifth-generation Oregonian, and I also have a foundation that balances affordable housing with historic preservation so that we can have what we all want, more livable communities. First of all, as a developer, I have to say that we're doing well. We are building lots. It's an amazing gold rush for us right now. And this bill is a handout for developers. And the problem with it is there is no mechanism in the bill to create affordability. And if you go through there, you'll find that they ask that developers will build as much affordable housing as we build luxury housing. But there's no mechanism to ensure that that happens. That means it won't happen. We'll just build what the market will bear. That's how it usually goes. Personally, I was out this morning at 5 a.m. Watching my crews build affordable housing or get our equipment ready to build our first affordable housing project for the foundation. I'm doing that because that's what I believe in. But as a market, as a marketplace, we're going to build more luxury unless we create a bill that does that. By giving us developers everything that we want in this bill, by suspending discretionary design review, by speeding up the process, by opening historic districts so we can load in more McMansions and so on, you're taking away your ability to negotiate with us. You need us as an economic engine to build our way out of the affordable housing crisis. This is only a supply bill, and the speaker admitted that it is just a supply bill, not an affordability bill anymore, as it is. And that she said that simple economics, more supply is going to help with affordability. It's not like that. It's supply of affordability that is the question.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that. And I've called up three other people, and we have a very short period of time. So I think I called Fred Leeson, Dean Giswold, and James Gorder.
Fred Leeson, I'll try to be very brief. I'm board member of the Architectural Heritage Center and past president. If you need an affordable car, you don't start out in the new car showroom at Mercedes-Benz, yet that's an analogy for the impacts of HB 207. We know that in Portland because in the last 3 years, we've lost more than 1,000 houses. If any one of those was replaced by an affordable house, I seriously doubt it. It makes perfect sense. You can't pay $400,000 to $700,000 for a house to tear down and replace it with anything affordable. To make way for these expensive new homes, we've displaced renters and reduced choices for entry-level buyers. In a society increasingly divided into haves and have-nots, HB 2007 assures housing for the haves under the deceptive guise of affordability. It will provide for more $1 million homes and for a new breed of duplexes costing close to half of that for each half. Your House bill attempts to make historic districts the guilty party in the housing crisis because for-profit builders cannot plunder those neighborhoods as easily as others. Funny, historic districts comprise less than 2% of Portland's area, yet our historic districts provide excellent opportunities for increasing affordable housing through accessing dwelling units and reconfiguring large homes into multiple units. I live in Irvington. There are several ADUs within walking of my house. They fit the context. They're just fine. We're not NIMBYs. We're yes in our backyards. Backyards is where ADUs belong. If you're serious about a housing crisis, let's get the best minds possible into the room. Let's include all of the stakeholders, and let's do it right. 2007 is not right.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Okay. My name is Dean Giswold. I live in Irvington, been there for 50 years. I'm the land use chair of the and responsible for administering the neighborhood part of the historic district. Irvington's been a historic district for 7 years. 500 applications, 98% approved. 32 ADUs approved in place. One a month, sometimes two, are coming through the process. They're not being delayed. We have never thought or we have never disapproved any ADU. I just want to tell you with what's in our historic district. It's the largest in Oregon and in Washington, I'm told. And this, it's integrated, it's multicultural, it contains modest, medium, and yes, a whole lot of large houses as well. And it also, and most.
Dean, if you can step away from the microphone. Oh. There you go. That's
okay.
Better.
And some are still affordable. It has two major public housing projects that meet the needs of really low-income people. Many duplexes, fourplexes, 32 ADUs that I've just mentioned, apartment buildings. I'd say there are between 30 and 50 apartment buildings in our district. Condos, office buildings, commercial buildings, a dental clinic, many good restaurants, and a Chinese noodle factory. And I bring one additional piece. We just approved last year what I think is the first heavy metal vegan brew pub and on Broadway. And that we were quite proud of that. The comp plan that Portland adopted already has zoned in various areas, including Irvington Historic District, more than double the capacity needed for the people projected to be here in the next 20 years. It's already in there. We approved that comp plan. We worked with the city. And that plan allows an ADU on every lot, a duplex on every corner, and we have a lot of those. I'll finish.
Thank you very much, Dean. Unfortunately, you're going to be the last person to speak on this, at least on the panel. I'd like to talk. I'll have something to say after you finish, though, okay. Please.
Thank you. Co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jim Gorder. I live in Southwest Portland. I served as the Southwest Portland representative on the city's residential infill advisory committee, and I represent United Neighborhoods for Reform, which is a volunteer grassroots organization whose goal is to preserve existing housing and to keep toxic waste from demolitions out of the environment. House Bill 2007 is a housing disappointment bill to families of modest means wanting to buy a modest home close to their families' jobs, and they're unable to do so at present. This will make it worse. House Bill 2007 is a housing displacement bill for our most housing vulnerable citizens, especially renters. They are being forced from familiar communities out beyond the end of the backsline, far from their jobs, far from their families, and far from their known communities. I urge you to vote no on this bill. Come back next session with a bill representing all stakeholders that will meet all our housing needs. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a very good segue for me. Thank you very much. One of the biggest issues we have, quite frankly, is the timing on dealing with this. We have, some of us would like to say 11 days left. Some would like to say fewer than that the rest of this session in dealing with these particular bills. We have, I think that this is going to, the affordability issue is the key for me, and it's the key for a lot of us. That's the reason that this bill was initially promoted, was to talk about affordability and how we get affordable housing. So I think we're going to see more conversations about this. We will probably not see this session another public hearing because we don't have the time. The timing right now is set up so that we probably will not get a chance to hear it. We will. There are people who are asking for it, so that's not a definite thing. But it's my view of how things are looking at this point. What I do think is we're going to see a lot of discussion about how we bring more housing into the state, especially more housing into the metro areas and into areas like Jackson County and Lincoln County and Bend, where we're having real problems with housing. So these are the kinds of issues that are going to continue. I apologize again. We simply do not have the time. If we could continue for quite a bit, I would want to do that. I tried to make sure. I know we didn't get an equal amount of presentation over the last hour. But that's unfortunately the way it works for us. I wanted to make sure that we got certain folks who had come to speak as well from different areas, and so we did that. And that's my best effort at this point. I really appreciate a couple of other things that everyone did. People did not decide to go into attacking people or characterizing others. They said, these are the issues, these are the concerns that we have, these are the ideas that we have, and we want to talk about those. I hope that continues. We have enough of the narrative that demonizes somebody who you disagree with. We didn't need that. We didn't see that here, and I really appreciate that. So I'm going to unfortunately have to say that we're going to come to the end of this particular hearing on this, but I'm sure the discussion will continue. And please, if you have more that you'd like to say, please submit it, because what will happen in the next time that we bring this up, people will go back to look at these kinds of issues and see how people spoke about them. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the hearing of today on Subcommittee on Natural Resources. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the hearing of today on Subcommittee on Natural Resources.